As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Was a very, very cub reporter.
We're just talking about people who were knobs in real life.
Yeah. Well, let's actually, why don't we start with a positive accolade for somebody. So I did a pre-recorded interview with John Turode, the MasterChef star and chef, earlier on today, which will go out on the podcast in a couple of weeks' time. And we had some technical difficulties, and he was so nice and patient. He was in a different studio somewhere in central London. But he was, you know, he had come out of another job that he was doing to do the interview. And actually, it's just a sign of a really, really nice person when they don't lose their rag or simply say, I'm sorry, I haven't got time for this. I'm in the middle of something else. Let's do it later. He could not have been more helpful and nice about it. So we just say hurrah.
Yeah.
Because some people are absolute gits. And Michael Winner was horrible. Yeah. I was only trying to do a phone interview with him, Jane. It was when I was a baby cub reporter. We just couldn't get the line to go through the desk. And I think I literally said, could I phone you back? Because we're having problems in the studio. And just this tirade came down the phone at me. And then he just put the phone down. And because I was really trying to, you know, I was trying to get on and, you know, prove myself. So I did phone him back and he didn't even bother saying anything, just put the phone down on me as soon as he picked up. And I just thought, it's only a phone call, mate. Yeah. Like a 5-minute phone call.
And how busy was he?
Well, I mean, he probably, what did he do by then?
Nobody, he was, I think loosely speaking, of
mid-1990s.
Film producer.
I can't name a Michael Winner film.
Nobody can.
But he was reviewing restaurants, wasn't he?
Oh, for this organisation.
Yep, so he probably had an urgent lunch appointment at Julie's Wine Bar. But anyway, he was just horrible, and it shakes you. It doesn't matter how many times it happens, actually. It still shakes you when somebody tirades you. And it would have been to promote something of his. You know, we wouldn't have been phoning him up to ask him about, you know, a relevant political something or other.
I just think, if you can't be nice... How do you finish that? Sorry. If you can't be nice... Be cheerful? No? Is that it? What is that phrase?
Well, I don't know. Isn't it more if you can't say something nice?
Oh,
say
that's
nothing
it.
At all.
Yeah, there we are. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
Yeah. But have you ever had one of those where someone's just really...
I've had quite a number of difficult, you might call them, celebrity encounters. I do remember as a very junior reporter having permission to ring the home of Dame Barbara Cartland.
Oh my word.
she lived in some splendour in rural Worcestershire. So she was, as far as we were concerned, that made her a local.
Yeah.
Because I worked for BBC Hereford and Worcester. So she was Worcestershire author Barbara Cartland. Which is very funny, which is what, you know, it's like the newspapers in Gloucestershire. I think the headline was Local Man Becomes King.
Yeah. And Northamptonshire Prime Minister John Major.
Cambridgeshire, I think.
Well, I was at Radio Northampton, so we claimed it.
Why?
It's only a county boundary, love.
Oh, I see.
So just look over the boundary.
You decided
it's
to
one
claim
of ours.
Him. Right, yeah. Okay. I mean, a lot of regional media are a little bit, they can be very territorial. Well, they've got to be territorial because that's what they're all about.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I think I did do a telephone interview with Barbara Cartland, which is arranged through her secretary. And I actually, this story doesn't have a very interesting ending because she wasn't unpleasant particularly. Mm. I mean, she was famous for lying on a chaise longue and simply dictating her novels.
Yeah. And I mean, they were best-selling.
There's a difference between
They were best-selling novels, Jane.
They were best-selling. terrible novels.
Yeah.
But listen, I'm the sort of person who goes to the press night of Metamorphosis, which is where I was last night. I did say I was going to the theatre. And whenever I go to the theatre, as a reward to myself for getting to the theatre, I have a glass of bubbly when upon arrival. And last night was no exception. But there's something really weird about watching Metamorphosis while drinking Prosecco. It just doesn't.
What would be the perfect accompaniment?
Yeah, the last time I went to that theatre, it was for Cinderella, and I've got to say, Cinderella was better than Metamorphosis, which isn't to say that, because Metamorphosis, of course, isn't bad at all, and it's a production directed by Lem Cisse, this one, and it's by a phenomenal theatre group called Frantic Assembly, and they do a lot of, I think, is it called physical theatre? It's all very carefully choreographed, just astonishing. But does anybody have a good time at a performance of Metamorphosis? It's just not possible, is it?
Well, I mean, some people probably bowled home wiser.
Well, it was a dizzy old crowd. There was a former BBC executive in the audience. She looked at me and said, "I know who you are." And I said, "I don't think you do, but we have met."
Did she think you were me?
Almost certainly. And I did notice as well, although I didn't get to speak to her, though she's very good company, Yasmin Alibi Brown was there.
Oh, I love her.
And I'm sure there were loads of other East West London celebrities in attendance at this. But congratulations to everyone involved, seriously, because it is so slick and it's deeply disturbing. And do you know when it was written? I had no idea. I thought it was vaguely the 40s. 1915.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I was astonished by that. So that would be written during the First World War. I mean, I hope I've got this right. I was really surprised that it was written so early on, and it's just.
Did it have an interval?
Very frightening. Yes, it does have an interval. Yeah. So if you want to see a man turn into a cockroach and his family be really horrible to him, that's the play for you, everybody. Metamorphosis.
Lovely job, Lee. Do you know what? I am quite drawn to Tracy Ann Oberman's Merchant of Venice, 1936.
Well, we did have an email saying how good it was.
Yeah, yeah. I think I might break my theatre fast in order to go and see that. And I know that you'll sympathise because you feel the same way about books, but when she said it's an hour and a half long, no interval, I thought, yep. Yeah. That appeals too. Mm. Well, look, I'm glad that you had an okay time.
No, I mean, nothing wrong with the performances or the staging was absolutely fantastic.
But did a little bit of you kind of go, oh, it's Tuesday night, it's dark, it's cold,
yeah, but
it's a bit late.
You go to that sort of thing, so the next day you can say, I went to the theatre.
Yeah.
And you just feel better about yourself, don't you? You're a citizen, a proper, upstanding, slightly cultured one.
And people are always so, so keen to hear.
Oh, I tell them anyway, Fee.
All about it. I'm going to read an email now, which is headlined, Unremarkable Genitalia. We're back in the room, kids. I'm a long-time listener and fan from the old place, but first time to write in ever to any show. This one comes from Alex. However, I felt compelled to write in because I've been listening to all of the great emails about unsolicited, unwelcome compliments and was reminded that many years ago my husband had kidney stones, in brackets, apparently worse than any childbirth could be, emoji, close brackets, was referred to see a consultant to check everything else was okay. The consultant followed up with a letter to inform him that his genitalia was unremarkable. Obviously a good thing that all was okay, but he's never really got over the faint praise. All made worse by realising the consultant lived one street away and we've bumped into him over the years on numerous occasions, much to my amusement and my husband's chagrin. Thank you for keeping me company over the years, Alex. Absolutely our pleasure. That is damned with faint praise, isn't it?
It is.
Unremarkable genitalia.
Yeah. Yes. In many ways, it's something we all wish for, really. Except I think with men, it's probably... we don't want to be... I mean, that's the point of the email, isn't it?
Yeah.
To be thought of as...
unremarkable.
A little bit run-of-the-mill. Bang average set of meat and two veg you've got there, mate. Good luck with it, them. I did once... Have you ever read one of those referral letters written by a doctor?
Yes. This perfectly pleasant broadcaster has been to see me today.
Well, that's nice, because I was referred to as this pleasant woman in her 40s.
Oh, okay. I got pleasant broadcaster on the last consultant's letter.
I could only dream of such a thing. It is very funny, that, isn't it?
And so can a doctor, that's such a good question, can a consultant or a doctor please explain
why
do they do that?
I don't know. Because is it? Do you know what crossed my mind?
Is it a euphemism?
Yeah. Well, is it a code, euphemism? Yeah. Is it code for middle class, like all of us? Is it that?
Yes. I mean, does pleasant mean kind of actually not particularly ill? Don't worry about it.
It could do.
Does it mean
might have gone to university?
You know, you probably charge a double. Should still come back
or that.
What
just
else
needs
could it
to
mean?
Be heard for a bit because she's a neurotic old bag.
Yep, that.
Could
yep.
be that.
So do tell us.
Yeah.
Yep, that's a good point.
Yes, you'll be out there. Why do you say pleasant?
Yeah.
And if someone's really unpleasant, what do you say then?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And is there a different term that's used for men? Because if we had this conversation amongst a group of women, I bet, you know, 9 out of 10 of us would have been described as pleasing, pleasant, amenable, friendly, something like that.
Yeah, it might just mean apparently washes, mightn't it?
Yeah, maybe the men are described as strong, sturdy, impressive, voracious, vital. The Sound app is called Soundprint, Jax Crawford. So that's the one that you can download onto your phone. And when you're in a very loud place, you literally just open the app and it records the decibels and it sends it back to a central database. So we are collecting information about places that are too loud or places that are perfectly pleasing.
It's Etty, actually, who has seen The Merchant of Venice 1936. And she does say, Fee, that it was powerful, moving and relevant. I tried to see it again, but it was sold out. But Etty lives in Stratford-upon-Avon, so she saw it there.
OK.
Where it was slightly easier to see it.
Yeah, I think it's come to London now.
Fee, it will be worth it, honest, she says. Stratford-upon-Avon must be an interesting place to live, Etty. Tell us more about that, because I, you know, you must just get so fed up with... What was the name of the playwright?
Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, yes.
Paul Abbott, I don't know. What. You know, we're watching No Offence again at the moment.
Yeah, remind me.
Joanna Scanlon, comedy kind of police drama that he wrote.
Yeah.
It's just superb.
Right.
It's not aged badly.
Right.
It is really, I'd just forgotten.
I love Joanna Scanlon.
Funny his writing is.
Yeah. What's it about?
So Joanna Scanlon is a cop. She's a commander of a unit, and they do this clever thing where there's one underlying storyline that goes throughout the whole series.
Is it a comedy or not?
Well, it's a comedy drama, but that makes it sound a little bit kind of buttock-clenchingly. It's just a very, very amusingly written drama, I think, is what I'd prefer to describe it as.
Yeah.
But there's a different little story in every episode and then one long storyline.
Arc,
thank you, darling. Arc is what I was searching for. Mm. But it's just cannily written. I think it's still a winner. And I didn't realise, actually, there are another 2 seasons. That's a lovely feeling, isn't it?
Gosh, and is that available on...?
That would be available. We're watching that on the Prime.
Oh.
Yeah. Have you not... You've got the Prime. Have you got the Prime?
Not on my telly. My telly is very traditional. It only takes the normal channels.
Okay.
You know, I've been having all that trouble with my satellite and... I know I'm the only person still with a satellite. Nobody understands why, least of all me. Why are you moving towards me, Kate?
Oh, we've got... Oh, no, we haven't got... The microphone's the wrong way.
It's all right, you can still hear you.
But are people getting the best of me? I'm sorry, this might be one of those where I've sounded bigger and that never goes down well. Birth memories... comes from Kate in Brisbane. Now, this is interesting because Kate in Brisbane has some kind of firm information about this. I've just listened on my way to work an email about birth trauma. I'm a psychologist who has a particular interest in trauma and in particular childhood trauma. What your listener has described experiencing, distress around tight things around her neck, with the story of the cord around her neck at birth, is truly a memory. We would call this an implicit or felt memory. It's in her memory network and stored in her body and the emotional area of her brain. And then the story, her system reminds her that something bad is associated with that feeling because it never got processed into memory because her brain was too immature. It's like a constant
nudge.
Yeah. My work is about often processing these early trauma memories and reconsolidating them with a new sense of the story, that it wasn't good, but it's over now, you survived it, and the heat of the memory is gone, and your own natural adaptive information networks facilitate this. I love this work and find it so fascinating. I mean, it does sound absolutely brilliant. Apart from anything else, it's a beautifully written email with loads of enormous words, all in the right place, Jane.
Well, I think that just hints at the incredibly high standard of our listeners.
All right.
Yes, I really do. And here is another one about libraries. As a new resident to my area, I, like many of your listeners, am consciously trying to make new social contacts. Imagine my dismay when, on starting to use my new library membership, I learned that all the local branches have self-service book checkouts and returns. Working and studying from home, my walk to the library to exchange my books is sometimes a slice, this is another great email, a slice of social fresh air in an otherwise online day. And being denied that short bit of chit-chat at the desk has disappointed me more than I thought it would. I used to volunteer in my old library for years, and I would always say, the library is about so much more than the books. It is a social hub. The brief chat at the desk was so important. I also wholeheartedly agree about the clunk of the old ink stamps. What a loss, not just for the audio pleasure, but also for everything that you used to be able to learn about the book's journey before it came into your hands, how many people had read it before you, and how often it had been borrowed, and so on. Thank you very much for that. And actually, there's another email on the same subject from Patricia in Tullamore in the Republic of Ireland. I'm on a train in Ireland just now, and I've opened up the new library book that I collected yesterday. It brought another library memory to mind. As a child and even later, I'd be curious to look at the stamping records on the little white sheet of paper inside the book cover, and the excitement of finding that I was the book's first reader in a crisp-paged new library book was just terrific. Yes, I really get that.
Well, you're at the start of the chain.
You're being the first in the queue. Yeah, the first in the chain of a book that probably went on to delight and entertain many hundreds of people after you. I wonder how many people would read the average library book before it's put out of circulation.
Good question. A librarian would
know.
It's
the second good question I've had in this podcast.
Yes, darling. Yes, darling. Well,
I'm on fire.
Yes, darling. What was I going to say then? There was something interesting. Oh, yes, books with inscriptions in them. You know, if you buy a book from a second-hand shop and you get it home, or maybe you flick it open in the bookshop, and it's got a very personal inscription in the front, do you like the book more or do you like the book less?
Another good question. And this one from the other lady. It's interesting. I find it... I think it's really sad, isn't it, that somebody has given away a prized, something that was at one point a prized possession.
I'm absolutely with you.
And that makes me feel a bit sad, and so I think I'd like it less.
Yeah, it makes me feel a bit funny about
almost
the book.
A bit intrusive.
A bit like it's not
mine.
It's not for me.
No.
Yep, isn't that weird? Because there's nothing lovelier than giving a book to somebody, you know, with meaning, really, and so you write in it. But you're right, I always feel like I can't really buy that book, actually, because it's still John's or Patricia's or somebody's.
Yeah. But it's a weird thing anyway, isn't it? I've got a book, a hardback book, of an edition of The Railway Children, given to my eldest daughter, I think, by the great aunt she was named after. And I find the inscription in that so sad, I can barely look at it, because it's written by a lady who was already well into her 90s. And, you know, I don't think my daughter even knows the book exists, but I do, and I will never, ever throw it away. But I wonder whether somebody will throw it away. They will throw it away, because it won't mean anything to
them.
Yeah,
it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, all this stuff about possessions is actually very, very, very difficult and very sensitive, because something precious to you will one day be chucked into a skip by someone.
Yeah, and you see, I know you love your audiobooks, but you can't do that with an audiobook. You can't, you know, stamp it as your own, send it to somebody. I mean, you can send it to somebody, can't you? But not with the same kind of meaning. Oh, we're reminiscing. Good Lord. I'm going to try and move it on now. This is just...
Shall we just start talking about antiques?
Recommendation. Well, I did say today, I've been completely overlooked as the new host of Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah.
That's a different story. I can't be bothered to give John Sobel another mention. Should we just move that on?
We need to reference. This is John Sobel in conversation with our showbiz pal Ian Dale, and telling Ian Dale that he'd been offered the job of BBC political editor but had turned it down. And this, not surprisingly, led your favourite professional carpers to reminisce about all the jobs they could have done had they only accepted them when offered.
I was up for match of the day.
And you said something else.
And I just couldn't do it. And Antiques Roadshow.
And Antiques Roadshow, yes, that's right. Yeah, okay.
Anyway, look, here I am. Now, this is a very good recommendation from Laura. I thought you might like to know there's an active conversation on Mumsnet about the brightness of headlights and a petition. Could it be publicised on the podcast? Well, it is being publicised now. Apparently, the AA and the RAC have both tried raising this as an issue, but they haven't had very much success. So do head off and sign the petition if you want to, because I think a petition, once it goes past, is 100,000 signatures. It does
have to do something.
Yep, it has to be discussed in Parliament. So that is a good idea.
Oh, that's right. Thank you very much for that, because I didn't know. And that sounds like maybe our involvement might lead to more people signing up.
Yes, and it would just be a really good thing to be part of changing.
Part of changing.
No, to be part of effecting a change.
Effecting a change. In our own small way, as two tiny women with gobs, we are effecting change with this podcast every single day. Now, Fee and I often reference our siblings. We're both very fortunate indeed to have one sister each. And frankly, I think we'd both agree, that's been plenty. So spare a thought for our...
Speak for yourself!
Spare a thought for our guest. It's a very cack-handed way of getting into this, because this is a relatively serious interview. And he said, is it relatively or is it very serious? Anyway, our guest is Calvin Wayman. And he grew up in a fundamentalist Mormon community in Utah in the United States. And just looking at it purely statistically, which obviously isn't the way you look at anybody's background normally, he has five parents. His biological mother was the first of his biological father's four wives. And it was only when his dad granted quite rare permission for him to go out of the community and do a business course at college that he actually really questioned his upbringing at all. He left the cult eventually, although it took him a while, and now lives in New York. And he's about to launch a new podcast about cults and about the thinking around cults. It's called Cultured. It isn't available yet, but it soon will be. So keep an eye out for that if this is something that interests you. Calvin began by telling me about just how different his life is now compared to his childhood.
It's two different lives. I mean, so one previous life on a farm, like around 44 siblings, you know, five parents in a fenced yard, never leaving, you know, like never going out in public, didn't even go to public school. I mean, now, I mean, I'm on my, not my own because I have friends and stuff like that, but now I'm not in a small rural town that was a farm life where I got up every morning, milked the cow and did garden work. Now I'm in New York City, you know, it's just so different in every capacity. Viewpoints on the world, like then I was super conservative, certainly a lot more. I'm politically homeless, but I'd definitely still say like more left leaning.
Tell us a little bit about the part of America in which you grew up. Where was it?
A small town in Utah. So the western states. But yeah, only about fundamentalist Mormonism is relatively small. Some people around the world would have heard of Mormonism. But then there's, and some people even consider that culty, but then there's regular Mormonism, but then there's fundamentalist Mormonism. And it's this, you know, secretive underground movement that's been living for, you know, four generations, like secretly living polygamy. So, yeah, it's just in a small town, most people wouldn't have ever heard.
But the point is that growing up in it as a child, you don't know that it's secretive or
not
underground.
At all. It was totally normal. Yeah, it was totally normal. People ask me all the time, what was that like? And I mean, that's a quite insightful thing you just said, because people, that's what the first reaction, what was that like? It was normal. Like, that's the most honest answer when I was a child. Like, there was nothing odd about it. My grandfather was also a polygamist. He had like 70 kids. My uncles also had like 20 kids, 30 kids. Like, my best friends were my cousins because we were all in the same church. Yeah, I didn't know any better.
And the schooling you had was provided by the cult?
Not even the cult. The schooling I was provided was my parents. So, in fact, schooling, I don't know why I had the certain DNA that I had out of all of my siblings, but so I was homeschooled, but what that really ended up doing is I had to basically become self-educated. Like, so it just led to my own intellectual curiosities as a teenager. And then that's what led me going to university. And going to university, I'm the first and only one in my family that has done that, because it was very much frowned upon to go to university, because that's going out into the outside world. It's getting exposed to ideas that could damn your soul to hell. So I actually had to convince my dad and grandfather to let me go, which my grandfather's was one of the cult leaders. And that's what kind of kicked everything off. We wouldn't be here today. It was a single philosophy class in college that created the crack in the whole thing. Quite terrifying.
And did your fellow students treat you as an object of curiosity?
No, because we were trained to keep it very secret and quiet. I did not talk about it at all. Like, my whole life was secretive. We were raised, because living polygamy, it was illegal. And like having multiple wives was illegal. So we were raised to never talk about it to anybody on the outside world. So if a car came down our dead end street, we were trained to hide behind a bush or run in the house so that they didn't see so many kids and even suspect that it was probably a polygamous house. So I didn't tell anybody.
And your mother, your biological mother.
Yeah, yeah.
What was her, can you tell us about her status within the family group?
Sure. She was the first mom. She had 12 kids.
She's the first wife.
That's what I mean. Yeah. She was the first of
the
four.
Okay.
But in my family, there wasn't really, I mean, it was the dad. He was definitely the hierarchy. He was the one in charge. And then the moms were like below him, and they were all pretty equal as far as status goes. And, And again, it was all in one house. So I have my biological mom, and certainly there's a closer connection with your biological mom, especially when you're young. But the way we were raised is they were all my moms. All four of them were my moms, not just her.
I just don't understand that dynamic.
Totally.
I mean, it's just completely baffling.
Totally. Yeah. Makes sense.
So mealtimes, I mean, take us into your mealtimes.
Have you ever watched Harry Potter? I mean, it's just like living at Hogwarts. That's kind of what it feels like to me. Like when I, like going in, like with big long tables, you know, a big long table. We'd usually do buffet style. So we'd get up after prayer and then get up in the queue, form a line, get your food. And, yeah.
And was there lots of argument?
Oh, yeah. For sure, especially among siblings. Lots of argument among siblings. In fact, that brings up another point, if you're curious about the dynamic of the family, because with that many kids, it almost felt like its own, like this is me just retroactively looking at it now, it's like its own village where the parents were like the government, and the kids were like the citizens. And so there was like this kind of distrust in a way where we, like the parents could get us in trouble. And so it was the siblings. Yes, we would fight and argue with each other, but also we would kind of cover for each other. Like if one of us were going to sneak out of the house for any reason, like to go down the street to a McDonald's, you know, and get like that was, you could get in a big trouble for something like that, like just leaving the property. So we would like find ways to cover for each other. But yeah, just like in school, if you're living in school all the time, you're going to have the Malfoys that you just butt heads with. And that's kind of, so I had siblings that, you know, that I butt heads with, and then others.
Well, I mean, there were 43 of them.
44. Yeah. There's 45 of us.
44.
Total. Yeah.
Okay, right. Forgive me. Yeah. Sorry, I just forgot one there, which is probably not that difficult to do.
Yeah, exactly.
And do you? Who did this system suit? I mean, one assumes that it was great for your dad.
Of course.
Pretty horrific for the women.
I mean, I think that's a valid assessment. Sure. Yeah. It all started with this guy Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith is the founder of Mormonism, and he. There's a lot of controversy around how he started polygamy, but in my upbringing and what is still purported by the communities in which I come from is that polygamy is a divine practice. It is the way to live. In fact, in Mormonism, there's three levels of heaven. And this style of living is the only way you can get to the highest heaven, which of course sounds incredibly convenient. But yeah, like we were taught that, I mean, we came to Earth to get to choose good over evil so that we could get back to heaven. And the Bible says to multiply and replenish the earth. So this style of living is how you can multiply and replenish the earth, like have as many babies as possible, get souls here that are just up in heaven waiting to come here, waiting to progress. But that's certainly a very, like, doesn't take a lot to recognize that point that, yeah, it does not, there's not a whole lot of equity there, let's say.
Yeah, it is very difficult though, isn't it? Because the line between cult and religion is actually pretty blurred for a lot of people.
That's so right. And the way I even like to think of the word cult is, even the word cult is not black and white. It's the way I viewed it, having to deconstruct this entire belief system and rebuild, is it's like on a sliding scale. And so I like the word culty. Like there's a lot of things that are culty. Like when I left the cult, I left it at first thinking, okay, that's behind me now, and there's nothing else that's culty in the outside world. That's just not the case. You know, there are other things that are culty. It could be something as, yes, other churches, other religions. It could be a yoga studio, you know, like it depends. Yeah. Like I say that kind of jokingly. There is a blur. It's not always obvious what is a cult, what's not a cult.
Your father, was he a tyrant?
Yes. Yeah, unfortunately. I think that's a fair... Yeah, he didn't really... He had a dad in my grandfather who was one of the church leaders that, you know, who's a World War II guy, very rule-based. And he was also... My grandfather was very beloved. And I think my dad was never given the skills on how to manage any sort of... if anybody stood up to him or didn't give him the same respect that he was used to seeing people give to his dad. And so, yeah, in some ways I would describe it almost as my family was like a cult within the cult in a way where, yeah, he was, and it's kind of sad because as life went on, as soon as the kids, you know, could leave the house because they got old or married or moved on. And then just seeing, like, it felt like that he had all this control, and then just seeing how many of them just fled and the relationships kind of just completely shattered. I mean, it's kind of sad for him in a way, especially as he's getting to the end of his life now.
Have you got a relationship with him?
I do now, yeah. We had a big falling out when I left. A major one over simple things. Like, I went after I had left I was out for a couple of years and I went back for a family barbecue. And this might seem silly, but I went dressed like this. And in my upbringing, you couldn't ever wear short sleeves. And so,
so you just had a t-shirt on.
Yeah.
T-shirt
exactly.
And just, jeans. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And we essentially got into like a fight in a way. Like he was really upset that I, you know, was wearing short sleeves. And that wasn't, it was actually the first time any male especially had just kind of not, we were taught if he ever was angry or mad at you to just take it like a man, whether you're 4 years old and getting a licking or you're a 16-year-old and getting a lick, like getting, you know, reprimanded as well. And so that broke the relationship for a while. But then a couple of years ago, in 2022, we found out he had, you know, he has stage four prostate cancer. And so at that point, it was just like, you know, when the clock is ticking like that, so much of the past just kind of melts away. And so last summer, we had a rekindling of our relationship, spent a lot of time together in the summer. And, in fact, I'm flying out to Utah next Tuesday just to see him because I don't know how much longer he's going to be here. So that's kind of where things are now.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
We are talking to Calvin Wayman, who grew up in Utah as part of a fundamentalist Mormon cult. He had five parents and over 40 siblings. I asked him how many of the siblings are still living as part of the cult.
Actually, a good chunk have technically left. I'd say about half of them are still in it. This is in stages. It's in because there's leaving it, as in saying, I don't really want to go along with the tenets of the church. But most of them, in fact, 99% of them are still in the bubble, as I would call it, like in the same geographical area with the same social ties. And to me, there's a lot of it still there, even if you're not fully believing it. There's only two of us that are like out, like living somewhere completely different. I have a sister that's in Hawaii with her husband, and I'm in New York City. Everyone else, you know, is in the same place that my family has been for, you know, four generations. From that perspective, I mean, I'm fascinated at this stage of, you know, human psychology and what makes us do what we do. There's a lot of things that can actually be extrapolated out of what's learned in cult-like environments to the rest of humanity. But it's just fascinating to me. It's really difficult to change, like, your social ties. That was the most difficult part, frankly. So people have asked me all the time. In fact, I've collected several ex-cult friends that kind of get it. I was just talking with a guy, Moses Storm, that also grew up in a cult. He has a comedy special just last weekend. And the one thing we both agreed on is growing up in the cult wasn't the hard part. Back to your point earlier, because we didn't know any different. The hardest part is the waking up to it, but then the leaving it. The leaving it is the most traumatic thing you can imagine, because like we're such social animals and feeling those, like when I made that decision to leave, it wasn't just it. I mean, 99% of the people I grew up with became estranged overnight, including family members. And so I can't remember exactly what made me start telling that, but that was the most difficult piece.
So I appreciate that you're flying back to see your dad because he's seriously unwell. If you, and I'm hoping that doesn't happen, but if you became seriously unwell, would a member of your family come to see you, take care of you, reach out to you?
So I'm close to about four of my siblings. So I would like to think they certainly would. The majority of my siblings I'm not that close to. It's surface level, and it's kind of a difficult thing, because it's not like you don't have love for people, but when you're, it's literally, I don't know if you're familiar with the old Plato cave story, like the philosopher Plato's allegory of the cave, but when it's kind of like talking to, it's like you were born in a cave and that's all you knew. And so you can relate to other people that are also in the cave. But after you're out of the cave for a while, inside of the cave, not only is it not very appealing, it's very difficult to have those common relation, like things that you can relate on. And even when you try to speak to things that are part of your natural everyday life, if you're speaking with somebody that hasn't been out of it and hasn't gone through that journey, it's just really difficult to have connections that are deep and meaningful.
Yeah. But I guess in a way, even those of us who certainly didn't have experiences as extreme as your own, almost all of us have left home.
Totally.
And it is not entirely dissimilar, is it?
It's not. In fact, that's been one of my favorite parts of the leaving, and also as I've opened up about it and started talking to other people, is I think there are these common threads of humanity in it as well that are just, again, maybe people can't relate to having 44 siblings, but there are people that certainly can relate to feeling alone, even among people that they're around. You know, they may not have been in a cult that is like a toxic thing above you, but they can relate to, like, I've had people relate hearing my story, like it feels like a toxic relationship that they were in. Like, there's good things and there's bad things. It's not just all bad. Mm-hmm. And when you're in it, it's difficult to see it. And there's a lot of work leaving out of it. So there's a lot of those things. There's a lot of those things that others that I think connect to, just because.
Yeah. With your experience and from your perspective, how do you view the kind of crazy, from my perspective, conspiracy theories that a lot of your fellow citizens seem prepared to buy into?
I'm fascinated by it. I'm not, this is one of the things that I talk about with my friends that are inclined to philosophy and politics and otherwise. I understand it in a way. Like, I literally have family that were at Jan 6. Like, when it was breaking news on CNN that people were storming the US Capitol, some of, like, I had family members that were changing their Facebook profile picture of them climbing the walls. And so, I don't know. I have an interesting front row seat to things, because I'm in circles that, you know, are more liberal and left leaning. But yeah, I also know people that believe the Earth is flat, and that Donald Trump was the second coming of Jesus, and on the surface, it's like, how could anybody believe X, Y, and Z? But if you can sit with it for, you know, 20 minutes to an hour, you can actually start to peel the layers back and understand it a little bit as to why it comes up. And I don't know how much time we have around that, but again, from my vantage point, it's genuinely fascinating to me to see what people fall into, but to see how people came to their conclusions on that side and other sides, you know, because, you know, New York City, it definitely has a lot of diversity, but it also, every single person in New York City isn't necessarily fully educated on every issue either, you know.
Calvin Wayman, and it is interesting there, that little bit at the end when he acknowledges that some of his relatives did end up taking part in the January the 6th insurrection, which suggests that people who are part of cults of one sort or another tend to head for that sort of event or that sort of set of beliefs when dangled in front of them.
You've chosen every single word in that sentence very carefully.
Well, I've also been very careful to say cult, extreme care, because it is one of those things
You've
that
done
can
very,
can
very well
trip up people. But I did mean what I said. I mean, everyone to a degree, because we only have one childhood,
It's the only one we're ever going to know, and no one ever chooses their parents. It's just, so you don't, on the whole, you don't actually question a lot about your upbringing, do you, until you are exposed to other upbringing.
Yeah, and a little bit of you finds an affinity with the family down the road, and then you take it back into your house and you say, well, Andrew's parents don't do that.
Well, that happened when I first had orange beans at my friend Marion's house, and we didn't have orange beans. So I went home and said to my mum, we've never had orange beans, I would like them. We'd only had green beans up to that point.
So orange beans being baked beans. And green beans being runner beans,
yeah.
Okay, God, there's a huge leap
there. It's like an Irish trickler of beans in my life, because now we have cannellini and white beans very regularly.
Yeah, please don't start
on the beans.
The
one thing, of course, you can't do.
No, don't start on the beans. Don't start on the beans.
But I will say about beans... No, I've got the Bold Beans cookbook, and it's a hard recommend, because this week I made a very, very nice chickpea stew.
Oh.
No, honestly, chickpea stew with dill, coriander and parsley, and really not much else. Economical and delicious.
Lovely. Can we end with a really lovely one from Roz, who is one of our very international listeners, Jane? It's called Tugging at My Heart Twice in One Episode. Hello, Jane and Fee. You really got me today. When you read out the listener's email about her father cleaning the family shoes, I could actually see my father, smell the polish and feel the stiffness of the cloths. He always insisted that the heel part joining the sole had to be polished too. That's dedication. And then the interview with Tim Marshall, asking him if he still looked up at the sky with pleasure, or words to that effect. Phew, the sky is where I look when I want to be with the man who loved me so much until the day he died. No, not the man I married.
Oh.
I know. I'm sorry that I'm yet another listener from Australia and not one of the very rare ones from Tunbridge Wells. Yes, we're not big enough in Tunbridge Wells, Jane.
We need to do more.
Although I did go there last year on a visit to the UK, meeting an old friend who travelled down from York. Neither of us had been there, which was why we chose it. But time travel was not what we expected. Going back in time, that is. A shout out to Debbie Gracie, who introduced me to your podcast. We love Debbie. A friend I met here in Melbourne, although she lives in Edinburgh. Keep up. She comes over every year to see family, and we bonded through cycling, and she even joined me on a cycling trip to New Zealand. Well, Roz, it's lovely to have you and Debbie on board. And I think that looking up at the sky thing is just actually quite profound. It is where we look when we want to think about people that we love. I think more than looking into a forest, more than looking into a river, you know, we look to the sky, don't we? And I found there was something so sad about everything that Tim Marshall told us about all the aggro that's already up there.
Yeah, well, we're just brilliant at exporting aggro, and we'll just keep on doing it.
Yeah, I'm going to choose not to see it. Mm. And it was interesting because he said that it didn't dull his kind of...
He still had that sense of wonder.
Yeah, mysticism, looking up at the sky. Mm. But, you know, I don't want to think that there are, you know, a couple of chemical toilets circling Elon Musk's Tesla up there and all the other detritus that's in sky. Because it's where our imagination is, isn't it?
I think Tim did say, didn't he? Although I think he didn't get the chance to actually complete the... Oh, no, I think he thought it was too distasteful, but he did say that the Apollo missions had left a lot of human poo on the moon. I mean... He completely misjudged us, because that's exactly the kind of stuff we do want to talk about. But he thought we should move on.
He did. We just wanted to talk about ropes, towers.
We'd have done half an hour on poo on the moon, but he didn't want to go there. Yeah. Right. Now, we should say you're very, very lucky, because on Friday there's an email special as well as the four-day-a-week off-air offering. I mean, honestly, can we do more?
Well, we could, couldn't we?
We could, but we're not going to.
Saturday and Sunday, but that's not an option.
I'm very busy with my beans. Right. Thank you very much for listening. Jane and Fee at times.radio.
Have a lovely evening when you get to it. Well done for getting to the end of another episode of Off Air with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Our Times Radio producer is Rosie Cutler, and the podcast executive producer is Henry Tribe.
And don't forget, there is even more of us every afternoon on Times Radio. It's Monday to Thursday, 3 till 5. You can pop us on when you're pottering around the house or heading out in the car on the school run.
Or running a bank. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you can join us again on Off Air very soon.
Don't be so silly. Running a bank?
I know, ladies.
A lady listener.
Kind of, sorry.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.